It's at 11 o'clock on a Thursday here at WFERLP South Royalton. It is time for Green Zine, your weekly environmental news magazine, often with a live interview, and that is the case today. Henry Swayze joining me in the studio, but we're going to start with some music after I let you know who brings this show to you each week. We are so appreciative of our underwriters, and they include the Yes We Can Collective, also a small restaurant in Randolph called Wit and Grit, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Daniel Liebowitz, Tom Wells, Solaflect, and Building a Local Economy. Their Resistance Hub had a very interesting gathering last night. They usually have something going on the first and third Wednesdays of each month. I'm sure you can find out more about it by going to bailvt.org. This group won a global Best Global Group award last night from the International Folk Alliance going on conference down in New Orleans going on this weekend. Wish I could be there, but I really am impressed with their music. We are going to head to the Baltic countries for just a little bit with the Baltic Sisters. I think you'll enjoy these harmonies. So from their most recent album, which is called Varav Varti Vartai, that is the Baltic Sisters with a piece called Sese Sudi. They hail from the Baltic countries. Now check your atlas there. Head north of Europe a little bit to the east, and I think you'll find Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. Really great music from the Baltic Sisters. Definitely seems to be really connected to the planet. And I'm going to bring up somebody who's always connected to the planet. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning. And today's program is going to be connected to the planet. We're going to have Abby White from the Vermont Land Trust. She's the executive vice president of that and does outreach for them. And we're going to one of the mission statements from the Land Trust is that they are trying to have people more connected with the land, not lose that connection with the land. that we seem to be doing as we get corporate jobs and move to cities.
Yeah, and this is a little bit connected. I think we're going to be talking about the effort of 30 by 30 in
yes.
that discussion, and that was brought up by one of our regular listeners, a local woman who's part of rural Vermont. So it'll be, I think, a pretty wide-ranging discussion. I looked up some of the projects at the Vermont Land Trust, including one that just got announced over in Rochester, Vermont. So that's going to be great. Talking with Abby White, and that's coming up in about 15 minutes or so. We've also, it seems like every week, we've got something coming in from, we'll call him our friend, Bill McKibben.
Yes. Well, Bill McKibben's, his newsletter, he rolls something out pretty much every week.
Mm-hmm.
And this was positive news, and I thought we could use positive news, even though it looks as though the military isn't moving into Greenland. We could maybe use something even more positive than that, because that's harebrained instead of, yeah, anyway. He says, I spent a lot of time writing and organizing about solar power. And that's mostly because it's the biggest tool we have to slow down the pace of global warming. I would put the comment, it doesn't slow down the pace, it just stops accelerating it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, which in turn is the biggest crisis the world has ever faced. And I would say that goes well beyond Trump, because we only have one at planet Earth and we need to take care of it. The scale of that crisis requires big solar and wind installations. So let's cheer for the news that solar last year supplied more power to Texas grid, Texas, the home of oil, than coal for the first time.
Bravo.
And that new plans have been announced for a 21 gigawatt. And I can tell you that's a lot.
Yeah, we don't have any of those around here.
Gigawatt solar and battery project for California, much of it on land that has been ruined by over-irrigation.
Oh.
So the irrigation in the Colorado River waters taken out, and right there on the, I'm trying to come up with the name, but anyway, right there on the Mexican border, they have industrial farming on a scale that I went there and spent two or three days there a number of years ago. And it was, there were roads around and about in the area, and those roads had no passenger cars on them. They were all tractors and tractor trailers, and they irrigate, they pull the Colorado River water in, irrigate the fields. It's a desert without the river. And the problem is that they leave hard water behind in the soil, salinity and hard water, and they try to flood the fields in such a way that a little bit of that water runs out of the very carefully graded field on the bottom end and is put back in the river to send off to Mexico as almost toxic material.
Thanks a lot, neighbor. Yeah.
Anyway, that's a little digress here. Go back to Bill McKibben. So they're doing a 21 gigawatt solar battery project in California, much on land that's been ruined by that over irrigation. And that coal generation has now fallen in India and China, the two biggest emitters in the world. I think that India beats the United States for the first time in half a century. So there are the kinds of developments that could start to shave tenths of a degree off of how hot the planet eventually gets. Now he's got his terminology right. The problem is that what that greenhouse gas that we're putting up now is going to continue to warm us for a long time. And I think we're already in a situation where we need to pull it in. But I just wanted to put in a plug for the fact that not Trump's world with it all about being burning more fossil fuel, but the rest of the world is getting on board with getting away from fossil fuel and getting on to cheaper energy and figuring out smarter ways to do it.
Yeah, you know, and between what changes are let's say rules and laws and projects have been stalled here as far as renewable energy and trying to be a little bit more carbon friendly in the United States. The U.S. clearly during this current administration is being left behind, and on other trade routes and things. And I think our neighbor to the north, the prime minister, I believe his name is Mark Carney in Canada, made a very strong speech to at the Davos Economic Summit yesterday before our, well, all kinds of names, but I'll call him our president, spoke, and basically saying the rest of the world needs to start getting used to the idea of maybe going forward with things without the United States as a partner. And if we continue to fall behind in renewable energy or gut systems, although it's good to see the judiciary standing up, I think four major offshore wind projects have continued construction. Most of them were nearing completion, and the courts have allowed them to continue despite the order that came down from the White House. So it is there. We live in interesting times, as they say, Henry.
Yes, yes. That's a Chinese curse.
Okay. Yeah, and actually, speaking of China, there are countries that normally would not be trying to enhance their economic relationship with China, but they're starting to take a second look now because...
Well, it's interesting. The American car market with electric vehicles has been more expensive. They have... they started off being...
more luxury cars.
More
big,
luxury
big
cars.
Big cars pushing $100,000, you know, $75,000 to $100,000 at the beginning.
And they're building them more and more. The newer models are dipping into the muscle cars. So with the enormous torque you have with an electric vehicle... you can get a lot of acceleration. And I think a standard passenger car on the U.S. market, they consider if you do 0 to 60 in between 6 and 7 seconds, you're able to take care of yourself just fine for accelerating onto a lane in the interstate and things like that, where you have to do big speed changes in fairly short area. And the new muscle cars, there are ones out there that will do 0 to 60 in 2 seconds.
A lot of energy being used there, that's for sure.
And it's, you know, it plasters you against the headrest on the seat. I mean, it's a lot of G-force.
Yeah.
And it's, in order to do that, they have to build a heavy, big car.
Yeah,
and,
more materials, bigger batteries. And more precious metals.
And it, you know, I have that little meter in my electric car that tells me how many miles per kilowatt I'm getting.
Yeah.
And when I heat the car up on my way down to the station this morning, I was going downhill and I was usually get almost 100 miles to the kilowatt by the time I've come off the high ground. But with all of my heaters going, I got a mere 3 or 3.5, it depends upon where you measured it, miles to the kilowatt. So if you think about that, kilowatt electricity on Vermont's most expensive power, Washington Electric, is 29 cents. So if I'm getting 3 miles for, let's call it 30 cents for easy, I'm getting 10 cents a mile for my electric usage. And if you have gas at
350,
we'll call it three for
three.
Now.
I mean, it's three.
It's really cheap.
Yeah, it
right
has
now.
Come down.
It's crazy cheap. That's all supply and demand, nothing else. they can't produce it for that and drill new wells and so forth. But if you and who knows with the environmental cost that is left behind, you know, all the externalities of heating us up and pollution that goes with it and so forth, affecting our breathing and. All right, so without so let's do back to the math equation.
Yeah,
so,
I'm really getting in the labyrinth here.
So there's 10 cents a mile, and at $3 a gallon, you've got to be actually getting 30 miles to the gallon on that $3 gas to get 10 cents to the mile. Comes out about the same. But I know that my partner's new hybrid Honda, that when she heads out, that vehicle's supposed to get 40 miles to the gallon, but it also has to warm up the engine, etc. And she more typically gets about 22 miles per gallon. That's a lot of short driving, and that's what she uses that car for.
Yeah.
So she's not making it. It's costing her more than, so on a pure dollars and cents, even with the very, very low gas prices right now, electric is cheaper.
Electric is cheaper. Not it's caught up a little bit because the cost of electricity around the country has gone up quite a bit. So that sort of 3-to-1 ratio, I don't think, is there anymore.
So New England is one of the most expensive states
for electricity.
I can post on our notes a very interesting chart that shows the prices for electricity all across the country.
Okay, yeah. I'd like to see that chart. Hey, before we're closing in 3 or 4 minutes away from welcoming our guest to the show, shall we get to Bird Note?
Yeah, I forgot about that.
No,
so,
I didn't.
So the Bird Note that I picked out is a nod to the importance of habitat for birds, and that's that connection to nature that we need to be paying attention to and the land trust works on.
Okay, here we go. Lewis's Wet Woodpeckers and Pine Forests. Bird Note here on Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. The Lewis's Woodpecker's glossy dark green back, red face, and pink belly make it look as if it belongs in a tropical forest. But this species is, in fact, an icon of the American West. A temperate migrant, this bird breeds across the western states in mature ponderosa pine forests and then moves south in winter. A century of logging and fire control has taken its toll on these mature pine forests, the preferred nest site for the Lewis's woodpecker. It takes a long time for a ponderosa pine to grow large enough for the woodpecker to carve out a nest cavity. As nest holes have become scarcer, so have many other species that rely on them. For example, the tiny flammulated owl has also declined. The moths that make up its diet are absent during northern winters, so it is highly migratory, wintering in Mexico and Central America. Thus, its fate is also tied to the health of tropical habitats. But there is hope. Lewis's woodpeckers also nest along rivers in large cottonwoods, trees of little value for timber. Furthermore, many remaining tracts of old-growth ponderosas are protected on public lands, and the trees are growing larger as we speak. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
The birds are flying by, and the southbound Vermonter is going by, the train behind us, of course, using less energy per passenger than a one person in a passenger car. We're going to be hearing from our guest here but in just a moment from the Vermont Land Trust. But I want to get this bit of news out for those of you who are into your local flora, fauna, soil, rock formations, etc. The Tunbridge Conservation Commission, I'm going to just hit a button here and make sure that happens there and make sure this happens here. The wonders of live radio. But I know that Walter Pullman is coming in to the Tunbridge Public Library to present a program tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. And it is called From Bedrock to Maple, The Landscape of Tunbridge. And once again, this is being put on by the Tunbridge Conservation Commission. It is the first of their winter evenings. They've got about four or five of them, and that will be tomorrow night at the Tunbridge Public Library. Well, the light just went off. It's a very good light, and we're going to welcome our guest to the studio, and I'll let Henry do the introduction.
Hi, Abby.
Hi.
This is Abby White, and she is the vice president of the Vermont Land Trust. And Abby, we've just gotten through listening to about birds and the habitat and needing many birds that are cavity dwellers needing older trees left for them to make cavities in. So that's a link into to the land trust conserving things that. That are closer to nature.
Yeah, great.
So I'm going to let you give us your approach, your elevator talk on what the land trust does. Let you start off with that, and then we'll get into trying to look at how well we're doing and. Are we on target to keep ourselves related to the natural landscape? Great value. I mean, I moved to Vermont in 1965, and I had an architect school friend who moved up here at the same time and got a job with the state. And he happened to take our valley, the Tunbridge Valley, and did an evaluation of how many people either worked on the land or worked for a support industry on the land. And it was a very large proportion, like 85% of all the people in the Tunbridge Valley did that. And now the number of farms and the relationship to the land has changed radically. Anyway, just a background on kind of
thank you.
What I saw over that period of time. Yes, Land Trust.
Okay. So thanks for having me on your show. Vermont Land Trust is a statewide conservation organization that was founded almost 50 years ago in 1977. And since that time, we have protected over 650,000 acres of land. So this is roughly 11% of the land that's in Vermont. This is all privately owned land. And so when you legally protect land, that means that you protect the natural resources that are there, the soils, the water, the trees, the wildlife habitat, and you prohibit development. And so Vermont Land Trust always has been focused on primarily on working lands, although we do a lot of natural and wild land conservation as well. But during our time, we've also conserved over 1,000 farms in Vermont, hundreds of thousands of acres of forest land that provides for connectivity for wildlife, protects rare and endangered species and natural communities, provides essential flood resilience, especially now as we're seeing more extreme weather events in Vermont. So that's just a snapshot of our work. We partner very closely with landowners, obviously. So these private landowners have made decisions to conserve their land, and we use a legal tool called the conservation easement. And once the land is protected, it's protected forever. And so not only do we work with landowners at the beginning of the process, but we have lifelong relationships. Not only do we ensure that those protections are upheld, but we provide forest management plans for landowners where there's forest land. We work to connect them to resources throughout Vermont. That could be business planning resources if they operate a farm or forest business. We continue to provide ecological restoration and improvements on the land. So in the case of farmland, if there's streams or wetlands on a farm, which really is most of the farms in Vermont, there might be some soil erosion over the years. And so we work with farmers to stop this erosion from happening and restore stream banks and restore wetlands. So there's a lot of what we do. It's not just protecting land, but it's that lifelong relationship with landowners to ensure that the land continues to be healthy. And then it's also community access and education and connecting people to the land, whether that's through trails or community gardens or just educational opportunities. That's become a much bigger part of what we do through our events and through just other educational offerings. So that's just a bit of a snapshot of what we do. It's in deep partnership, as I said, with communities and landowners and lots of other organizations that are working to ensure the protection and the viability of our lands in Vermont.
Yeah, that's great. So what's been happening, if you look at, say, the last 10 years, are things accelerating in terms of conserving land? Are you seeing it happen faster and faster, or is it kind of a steady pace?
It depends kind of how you measure success, and it can go up and down. If you're looking at acreage, it can really go up and down year to year, kind of depending on the parcels of land that are being conserved. So one year we might see a big jump because maybe there were 700 acres of forest land that were added that year, or 1,000 acres of forest land. So it really depends. But I would say that the pace has been pretty steady. I failed to mention the state's role. So through the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board, this is the vehicle that the state uses to fund conservation. They're a very close partner of VLT. And so this is really where a lot of the resources are flowing to VLT and then to the landowners to ensure that this land is protected. And so, we tend to do anywhere between like 30 and 50 projects a year, and it really ebbs and flows. But as we've conserved more and more land, so we, as I said, 650,000 acres, of course there's an opportunity to continue to protect land. And at the same time, there's an opportunity to ensure the viability and the health, the ecological health of the land that have already been protected. And so as time has gone on in VLT's history, we have continued to focus on conserving new parcels and then increasing our capacity to do stewardship and to do ecological restoration and to do community education and events. And so as the time has gone on, I think you see more of a balance in what we're doing. We're still doing protection of new land, but we're doing an equal number of work with the landowners through our stewardship and through also community connection to land. I'll just say another piece that we've been working on more in the past 10 years is connecting people to land through VLT's ownership. And so we own, you know, many acres of land in Vermont, all for different reasons. But some of our flagship properties that could be, that includes like Brewster Uplands Conservation Trust in Jeffersonville. On that property, it's a 600 and some odd acre property with two farms. We have farm partners. One of those farms is operated by Green Mountain Technical School with our students on the land. We have trails that we've been building. We've been partnering with Vermont Adaptive to build fully accessible trails. And so when VLT owns land itself, we're able to make those types of investments and have many, many more people on that land and benefiting, whether it's through the farms or through the trails. So that's another area of work that we're doing. So I guess the answer to your question is really it kind of depends on how you measure success. If you're looking at, you know, pure acres, it really has been pretty steady, though.
Right.
Let me turn my microphone up here. Could we stay with the farms? And we know that agriculture and farming have been such an important part of Vermont's history, but we also know as far as the dairy industry that we've been losing those type of farms at just a very steady rate and getting very low. So of the 1,000 farms that the Vermont Land Trust has agreements with, what happens when one of those farms that's a working farm that is made this conservation agreement, when it goes out, when they're no longer able to do that type of usage with the farm, what's the next step after that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And you're right that we have seen consolidation of farms, particularly in the dairy sector, farms getting bigger. At the same time, we've seen growth in smaller farms and farm operations that are successful that don't need that only rely on kind of 30 acres or 50 acres, and it really depends on their operation. We see a lot more diversified farms today than we did maybe 30 years ago. So, yes, the nature of farming is changing. And when a conserved farm goes on the market or a farmer is contemplating retirement, We like to be in touch, and one of the things that we strive to do is ensure successful transitions. And so, in the case of conserved farms that are going on the market, we often play matchmaker. Our staff are located throughout Vermont, particularly, and we have some really fantastic folks that are kind of leaders in agriculture. Farmland protection, they have relationships. And so we do what we can to get those farms transferred either to the next generation or transferred to a new farmer that has some interest in coming in and making a go of it. And this is also where, you know, VHCB is really an essential partner. Sometimes when those farms transition, there's additional protections that can be added. So maybe you can add some wetland protections, stream bank protections, and there's resources that come along with that often make the transfer a little bit more financially viable. So that's something that we are focused on and do what we can, right? It's We're seeing the cost of land and housing increase throughout the state, and that's something that is not just happening here in Vermont, but across the nation. And so, conservation is one of the tools that can help to increase affordability. But yes, it's not an easy challenge.
So. I know that just as land values rise, taxes tend to follow along not very far behind. And so for someone who is taking a piece of land that the soils need development and need to be improved in order to make really good products from it, get good production from it. How is that bridge made? Is there a bridging mechanism and how do you deal? I realize that when you have a piece of land conserved, you may get some reduction in property tax, but it isn't. I don't think it's a great deal. It doesn't make the property taxes go away, does it?
It doesn't make them go away. I'm certainly not an expert on taxes, so we'll defer to someone who is smarter than I in that area. A lot of our landowners are also enrolled in what's called current use in the state, and that is that's a tax system that supports people in farming and forestry on their land. And so there's some tax benefit that comes through other programs like current use. When it comes to, farmers are really a savvy bunch, and they are entrepreneurs. They are some of the hardest working people that you'll ever meet, creative people that you'll ever meet. And they're pretty savvy about getting access to the right, whether they're federal or state grants, to do improvements on their land. That could be soil improvements or forestry or kind of other equipment or infrastructure on the land. Certainly our team has knowledge and expertise in that area, and so if a farmer is really at a loss, then we can help to connect them to the right resources. And this is where the partners really come into play. So, for example, the InterRail Center in Burlington doesn't just operate the farm there on site in the InterRail. They also provide business planning services to farmers throughout the state through a program that Vermont Housing Conservation Board also funds. So there's like a network, a constellation of partners that are kind of wrapped around the farming community here in Vermont. And we're an important part of that, but by no means do we do it all.
Yeah. Do you have a sense? Let me jump over to the goal. I think it's a goal. Maybe it's a required law that we conserve 30% of the land in the state by
2030.
By 2030, and then 50% by 2050.
2050.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so I realize that your piece is just a component, that there's things like protecting state forests and there's a lot of U.S. Forest Service and state land.
Right.
How do you have any sense of how we're doing on that? On that goal to get to 30 by 30?
Yes, I do. And so that bill was passed in 2023, I believe, and it charted the creation of a plan to get to 30 by 30 and 50 by 50. It started with an inventory of what has already been conserved. And I believe it has been 27% of the state has been protected under what's called like a durable or permanent form of protection, some legal protection. So that could be a conservation easement on privately held land, but it could also be state-owned land, or I believe municipal-owned land may qualify as well, but I may be wrong on that. So 27% sounds good. However, in order to reach the goal by 2030, which is now only, 4 years away, we would have to double the pace of conservation in order to reach that. So as business as usual, no, we're not on track. And so the plan that's being created right now, actually it's going to be delivered this summer, is all about, what do we need to do in order to increase the pace of conservation.
Mm-hmm. Are you involved in that in any way?
Yes, very involved.
I'll bet.
And our entire VLT, a lot of folks from VLT have been involved in that. In the inventory stage where they were assessing what has been conserved and what do we know about these lands, what's included on the lands, we had folks with expertise on GIS mapping that were deeply involved in that project. We've had our experts in forestry and agriculture also involved. Our CEO and president, Tracy Hsiao, has been involved. So it's been a team effort, and VLT is absolutely committed to the success of 30 by 30. We have an important role to play. Private landowners have a really important role to play. Yes, we're in active conversation with Vermont Housing Conservation Board, partners at the state, other land trusts in Vermont, other conservation partners to really figure out where do we focus our time and attention to accelerate.
Well, I'm glad to hear that other land trusts are participating, and I'm not surprised by that. But let's get a little bit more granular. A lot of small towns, and we're in a rural part of Vermont here, have conservation commissions. And we started the show with announcing a talk that's being put on by the Tunbridge Conservation Commission tomorrow night. So when you're at that level, there are people that are concerned about conservation who may know of parcels that seem maybe ideal candidates that are currently maybe under current use, but not conserved permanently. Have you found conservation commissions as far as communicating with land trusts to be a valuable tool in maybe getting some more prospects to add to this effort towards 30 by 30?
Absolutely. The conservation commissions in Vermont are incredible. The volunteers that do this work at the local level have been some of the best champions for conservation and some of the best catalysts for conserving properties, just as you mentioned. And so we have close relationships with commissions throughout Vermont. And there's quite a few towns. I'm not sure if Tunbridge has one, but there's quite a few towns that have funds that can contribute to the conservation of land. So, yes, we've worked really closely, and we rely on people at the local level who really know the parcels, know which farms and forests could be at risk of development, know which natural communities need to be protected. We really rely on that intelligence. Where the Vermont Land Trust often comes in is in the legal transaction. So we're the largest land trust in Vermont. We have also, it's the largest organization, we hold by far the greatest number of conservation easements. There's perhaps 2,300, 2,400 conservation easements that we hold, and we are responsible for stewarding in perpetuity. So because we have that kind of capability, we are the ones. Other organizations don't want to duplicate that. It's expensive, right, to have a legal department and that level of expertise. So where we come in is lending that expertise in partnership. So we might work with a smaller land trust that doesn't hold easements or doesn't do legal transactions, but they do a great job at prospecting and landowner relations and kind of getting the deal initiated. And then we work on implementing and then continuing to monitor those easements in perpetuity. So it's a nice partnership, I think, that we have with land trusts. And we rely on these smaller land trusts and conservation conservation commissions. They're part of that community that makes this whole thing work.
Do you have any sense of how deep the local committees are, what percentage of towns have a conservation commission?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't have that information, but I know that the association would have it. Yeah.
We won't try to.
Yeah, we have a regular listener who has the answer to that question. We'll check with her, because there is there's a statewide sort of conservation group that does rally a lot of towns. If I had to guess, I would say probably more than half of the towns, but that's just a guess. You know, a question, and we had a local issue which is still going on, but this is about, you mentioned early that possible public access to some of these conserved properties and trails. When that comes up in a discussion and an agreement between the landowner and the Vermont Land Trust, is that usually something that there are trails already there and therefore they should be used in the way that they have been? Or does it come from the landowner mostly, or from the land trust advising that it would be a good idea to have some public access? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. So whenever the HCB is involved in a project, and again, Vermont Housing Conservation Board, this is public funds that they're putting to buy down the costs of to buy those development rights, essentially. The HCB often in their easements has requirements for public use. What we call dispersed public use, where there's not a trail, there's no signage, there's no parking, but it's people can go on that land, and so it's open for hunting, for example, or fishing. So we see that type of dispersed public use as something that VHCB requires. On farms, of course, that can be tricky. When it comes to more structured public use, whether that's trails or parking or signage, it's nothing that we require at all. Really, this land stays in the hands of landowners. We're there to support the protection of the resources and work alongside them. But really, if not for the landowners and their own decision to conserve the land, then none of this would be possible. So we really try to work in close partnership, especially when it comes to something like public access.
So in a way, the United States and I guess much of the developing world has made land ownership by an individual the way land is divvied up. But the indigenous people around the world, not just in the United States, one of my daughters spent 15 years in the South Pacific visiting island communities, and the community owned the land. There was no private ownership of a parcel. So and that meant that the decisions for what you did with that were a community decision rather than an individual decision, someone that, you know, was reaching retirement age and wanted to cash in their land, move to a smaller property, and make use of that cash to move them. Any thoughts on that philosophic question about throwing a big question open?
Yeah, I wasn't ready for that one, Henry. Yeah.
On that philosophical question, yeah, it's really a totally different mindset in the relationship to land. And we've been working with indigenous communities, you know, at least for over 20 years, and have learned a lot from working in partnership. And that, you're right, it is a totally different view of land and ownership of land. To some in the, I wouldn't say to all because I'm really not an expert, but to many in the indigenous community, ownership is kind of anathema to how they see land. You know, it's one of the tension points that exists within conservation overall. The type of conservation that VLT does is through a legal protection of land that stays within the private ownership of the individual.
And that's triggered by the person who owns the land loving the land and wanting to see that it continues to have that quality of natural state that they appreciate so much, I would think.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's not to say we do work with plenty of communities that come together and identify parcels that are important to them that they want to protect. And then, you know, they're in conversation with the private landowner. But community members do often play a really important role. Example, we've worked with maybe 30 or 40 towns in the protection of a creation of a town forest. And these instances, yes, it's often, the land is often, initially held by a private individual, but community members rally together and raise funds for the acquisition of that land, for ongoing operating funds, for trails or signage. So there's ways in which communities are very active in conservation, but it still relies on that kind of basic premise of property rights, which is quite embedded in the United States and New England in particular.
Yeah. So let's flip over to the other side, which is that Vermont doesn't have enough housing. Because we are in a reasonable sweet spot in terms of weather as the climate warms, there's going to be more and more pressure on us to have people who no longer find the place they're living habitable to come to places like Vermont. And so that pressure is just going to ramp up over time. And somehow you either build a wall around the state and say, no, you can't get in and too bad, or else you take a more humane approach and try to figure out how to work together with people and have it work well for everybody. And how do you do that? How does that interact? That I know there's pushback right now in the courts for the new land use bill that says if you're on a municipal sewer line and water that it opens up the ability for development without streamlines that and makes it much easier, and that's generating a clash with people no longer farming. I mean, Tunbridge, when the individual houses all have a strip of land behind them, even right in town, and not so much anymore, but it used to be that all those houses had, a milk cow in the backyard and had a vegetable garden, et cetera, that they were providing some of their own food. So just want to comment on that challenge, and where does the housing get built if we actually get to conservation by 50-50?
Thank you so much for the question. Housing and conservation can and have worked side by side, and so they are complementary. And in fact, the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board is an entity that really brings those two together. They make investments in affordable housing and conservation, and they've been doing it for 35 years because, studies have shown, but practice has shown that when you invest in affordable housing, in communities and conservation in communities at the same time. It's the communities that thrive. Mm. And so where we need to build housing, and we definitely need to build housing, are in downtowns, in village centers, in areas where there is infrastructure and access to services. And so those areas, we do need to be building more aggressively. Those are not areas that where we want to conserve, right? Those areas close to downtown and village centers are not places where we want to conserve. And so I think that's important for people to understand that the housing community and the conservation community are not in competition for land. The land that we want to protect is land that supports biodiversity, ecological health, flood resilience. If we don't really tend to the protection of headwater streams and other wetlands, all of this development will be for naught. So we need to do both at the same time. As we invest in development, we need to also invest in protection of land. The other thing that's really important, especially for Vermont Land Trust, and I think for the state as a whole, is protection of farmland.
Yes.
Is protection of farmland. There's another initiative that we don't have time to talk about today that is striving to protect 30% or achieve, let's see, what is it? It's called New England Feeding New England.
Uh-huh.
And it's about, the goal is to ensure that New England can feed itself with 30% of food products coming from New England by 2030.
Mm.
And so it's this vision for food security in the region. And where is that land that is going to support 30% of our food in New England? That's Vermont, that's Maine. And it's not just for food security. There is so much economic opportunity. Imagine if 30% of the residents in the Boston metro area were eating from their local food shed, their regional food shed. Think about that economic opportunity. So we absolutely must protect farmland alongside these headwater streams and these sensitive natural communities in this forest land that does so much for us. So that's my sense of it, is that both of these things can happen at the same time. People that are trying to create tension where it doesn't exist should let's all focus on what we can agree on. And yes, we can agree that these downtowns and village centers need some development, and we need some housing relief in Vermont.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That's a great place to leave this. And it also points to the fact that the way to make your community be more enjoyable is to be more involved with the community, to
mm-hmm.
to be aware of, you know, pay some attention and try and find a place that you could land up being engaged on some level.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well,
thank you for the opportunity and the conversation.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's great to have you on and representing the Vermont Land Trust, Ann.
Okay.
We'll
talk again sometime. It's been lovely. Appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay. Thank you again, and be well.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
All right, Henry, I've got a lot of tabs, but I don't think we're going to be opening too many of them, but maybe I will save them for next week. I'll just give a little teaser. Orion Magazine is mentioning 10 new environmentally related books that folks might want to check out. We'll maybe take a little review of part of those next week. Also, she's off the air, but there's a story that just broke. The Vermont Adaptive has made an arrangement with the Vermont Land Trust and a large landowner in Rochester to have a whole recreational network for adaptive recreational users over there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find that in Vermont Digger, a great source for information. And I will do the underwriting credit, then leave it to you, Henry, for final comments as we get close to finishing up with a little music from those folks from up there in Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Green Zine has been brought to you today by Soliflect, Bail, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. And Henry, we have a little bit more than a minute to go, so I'm tossing it back to you.
Yeah, I want to let people know that next week we will be having Jessica Plum, who is an environmental filmmaker, and is going to be contrasting the upcoming film that she's working on is going to contrast what happens in the Arctic wilderness area that Trump has thrown open and comparing that with Scotland, where humans have deforested it.
Uh-oh.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I'm going to point out on the front page of the Herald, John Freitag from Stratford has written a very interesting article about a huge 2,000-acre property that has just changed hands over in the Taylor Valley sector.
Ooh.
Of Tunbridge. You're familiar with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is on the front page. So check out your Herald. And once again, thanks for joining us. We're leaving you with music from the Baltic Sisters. Look forward to being with you next week here on WFERLP South Royalton. Bye, Henry.
Bye-bye.